answer your question?
Sort of.
Sort of.
It's sort of what I know, but right. Then when it gets down to brass tacks, I really feel like I'm a lot of times sitting there trying to figure out, okay, what really is a fair, if you have people come for a class and they stay overnight, what is a fair rate to feed them for a day and
sure.
stay overnight? What's fair?
It really is relative. I mean, it's really based on the particulars of the, like I said, the location geographically, the level of expertise. If you've been doing something for 30 years, you have a bigger skill set amassed. If you have a wide reach, an audience that's already... I just set them up, and with this wind, forget about it. It's a house of cards. So I'm just going to show them to you. And the reason I'm showing them to you is I think they have some of them in the bookstore, but also it's relevant to what we're going to talk about today. So I have a book series called Homemade Living. At present, there are four titles. And a year from now, there will be a collected edition of them called The Essential Book of Homesteading, which is a title with a lot of weight. So in any event, there are four topics right now: keeping chickens, keeping bees, canning and preserving, and home dairy. If you live in the area, these are classes that I regularly teach at Villagers Homesteading Supply, which is an urban homesteading supply store in West Asheville. And the chickens class I teach at the local community college. I'm teaching it next week. It'll be like the 17th time I've taught it, I think. And then I wrote a book called A Year of Pies, if you like pie, for sweet and savory pies to enjoy the entire year. Which came next? This one. Handmade gatherings. There are 16 potlucks in here that are based around the seasons. And for each of the potlucks, so say there's a spring one, there's a wild foods potluck, or maybe there's an egg potluck. And everybody brings something that's based around that particular theme, but everyone also contributes to crafts and activities, so it's kind of like all hands on deck, sort of entertaining, deeply collaborative, so that everyone can have fantastic get-togethers without Martha Stewart's budget, which I don't have. And the last book that I wrote is called Quench, and it is half of it is alcoholic and half of it is non-alcoholic, but it runs a spectrum of beverages from kombucha to buttermilk to lemonades and sodas all the way down to hard cider, limoncello if you want to make homemade Irish cream or mead, that's all in there. And then I have three books coming out in the next 2 years. So that's what I do. Different suggested uses that I'd like to propose for ways that you can diversify the use of your homestead. And your homestead could be a balcony apartment, or it could be, you know, 400 acres, what have you. It's whatever the definition is as it applies to you and the particulars of your situation, which will inform what kind of things you can do on your land. And some of these may apply, some of them may not. But there's a lot of different things that you might not have considered. And I want to start by what my husband calls the wheelbarrow analogy, or the wheelbarrow metaphor. Just a show of hands, how many of you remember the movie called The Princess Bride? Okay, good. So in it, there's this one pivotal moment in the film where the three central characters are trying to overcome a castle that's heavily fortressed with about 60 soldiers who are all, you know, guarded and armored. And they say, how can we do it? And we say, we've got your brawn, my brains, and your steel, you know, sword weaponry. And they start trying to come up with this plan. And at one point, the guy who's the brain says, who is in partial paralysis at that point in the film, he says, if we only had a wheelbarrow. And one of them says, what about that wheelbarrow that we had? And he said, the brain says, why didn't you list that in our initial accounting of assets? So what I want you to think about today during the conversation, and then when you go home, and solicit feedback from your friends or your family, people that know you well, are what are your hidden assets, whether it's directly on your property or some sort of skill or talent that you have that other people might be interested in learning about? What is your wheelbarrow analogy? What is hidden in plain view on your homestead, or something that you could offer on your homestead that you might not have thought about before? And before I get into listing what all of those are, I want to talk about two issues: liability and taxation. So those are things to consider. Most of the time when you have someone on your property, it's your mom, your dad, or your best friend, and you don't ask them to sign a waiver to
release you from any potential litigation if they get stung by a wasp. But when you have strangers on your property, the dynamics of the relationship that you have with them are altered. So something that you might want to think about if you're going to host on your homestead and you have strangers is some sort of liability waiver that you could have that releases you from potential litigation. There is a intentional community that also has an educational component. They had a booth here earlier today, but I heard the tent kept getting blown away. It's called Sacred Mountain Sanctuary. It's here in Candler, in the town that I live in. And they have an educational component that's a Waldorf-based program, goes through the eighth grade. They have a residential component where people can buy parcels of land and build homes. And then they also have a commercial aspect where they're growing herbs for market, medicinal and culinary herbs for market. So that's the way that they've diversified their land. That's 300 acres. But they have a liability waiver. If you come onto Sacred Mountain Sanctuary grounds, you fill it out. And if you'd like to see an example, the reason I mention them is if you go to sacredmountainsanctuary.org, under their resources tab, their liability waiver is there. And they've given me permission, if you would like to use that as a model to create your own, by all means, feel free to do so. That won't cover you for everything. It basically is like the ground zero for covering yourself against potential litigation. And I don't want to scare anyone off by talking about this first, but it is something that you really need to be mindful of. I taught this class a couple weeks ago. There's an annual conference here in Asheville called the Organic Grower School, and I taught this exact same workshop, and I solicited feedback from the crowd. And what I found, because people are already doing diversified things on their land, was becoming an LLC is the best way to cover yourself. You can do it online. You could retain an attorney. You could hire an attorney to do it, but you could also do it online. It's a nominal fee. A couple friends of mine have done it for their own businesses, and they said it was like between $100 to $150 to become an LLC. You would not be being sued potentially as an individual. It would be the corporation, the LLC that would be, that litigation would be against. So something to think about. I've also heard that in the state of North Carolina, North Carolina Farm Bureau has fantastic insurance that's offered for especially any kind of agrotourism. Also becoming a member of North Carolina Agritourism and South Carolina and Virginia, if you're local, they have agrotourism boards that if you become a member of those organizations and you put a little placard up on a fence at your property, that also gives you some degree of coverage too. So like a lot of apple orchards in the area, you go there, you'll see member of North Carolina Farm Bureau, and that affords them some protection, especially with like school children coming through all the time and, you know, falls and tumbles and yellow jackets and whatnot. So think about liability waiver and insurance, and then taxation. I have a friend who's an accountant. He mostly works with nonprofits and churches, but I asked him about if we're talking about trade or barter or a cash sort of exchange, what needs to be declared? Is there a certain threshold, like beneath that, you don't have to declare it? And his stock answer, and I'm just gonna provide that today, is that if you're getting paid to provide a good or service, you talk to your CPA about how best to report that on your tax return. So just keep that in mind, whether it's trade or barter, or if it's an actual economic exchange. That's something you wanna keep a running list of, any kind of expenses that you incur. And your CPA might be like, don't worry about it, don't report it. But I encourage you just to keep a running list, just in case, because you never know. But two things to think about in advance. So then we'll just jump in. And I think for the sake of time, if you have anything that seems really relevant to what I'm addressing, feel free to just raise your hand and either ask a question right then or offer any kind of information that you might already be privy to on the topic. It's a kind of a big group and we're at the end of the day, but I think we can have a group conversation. So are any of you familiar with land share, the land share movement? Anybody? Anyone familiar with the name Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall? So Hugh, if we were having this conference in the United Kingdom, it would be like asking if anyone had heard of Joel Salatin. Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall is the largest public advocate for sustainable farming and agriculture in the United Kingdom. He has done national campaigns for mindful practices with poultry, with fisheries and hatcheries across the United Kingdom. But what he's most well known for, he started with a television program on the BBC where he would he'd pick up roadkill and he would cook it into something, and had a whole show about that. And then he wild foraged. And but what he established that I have been deeply inspired by is called the Land Share Trust, or the Land Share Movement, where if you are in the possession of land, or if you're looking for land, so you want a farm but you don't have access to land, there's a database that was created where let's have a symbiotic relationship. So at its core, it's an agreement between two parties where one supplies the labor, the land, and the other supplies the labor. How that manifests is completely individual. You could have a a 4-monthly use fee that you request if you're the landowner. We did this a couple years ago on our property. The land that I live on, when my husband purchased it, he purchased it before we met, used to be an organic, edible flower and herb farm. And there were 3 large greenhouses on the property at the time, which we have since sold off because we just have a small homestead now, because we're doing all this stuff. We're not farming. But we still had the greenhouses, and I said, this asset is here. Let's make it available to some young farmer who would like to have access to land. And I was completely inspired by Hugh Friendly Whittingstall. And what we came up with, I advertised on there's a local wonderful organization called the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project, or ASAP is the acronym. They have a classified section, and I advertised available. Let's meet. And I highly encourage you, if you're going to do any kind of land share or farm share or garden share with someone that you don't know, to interview a couple potential candidates until you find the right fit. We received a couple of very enthusiastic replies, and then we figured out who was the best fit for us. And we did that for an entire growing season. And our arrangement was really simple. We just asked for 4 hours a week of help with us in our own kitchen garden. And around the property, because we have, it's mountainous, we have these 11 acres, but we do have a lot of different crops and things that we grow for our own family's use. And we did that for spring, summer, and fall. And then he was really young, this young farmer, and he moved on to another property. He also gave us, he was growing heirloom organic peppers and tomatoes, and he would give us produce periodically. But mostly he was growing and then taking to market to sell. So the Landshare database in the UK was an example for a lot of similar databases in the US that you could look for locally. WNCFarmLink.org has a database like that. If you want to list property that you have, or if you are looking for land, that's a place that you can check out. Otherwise, you could check out Transition Town Initiatives. Wherever you live, they have similar listings. Hyper Locavore has similar listings. You can find something on Craigslist. You can make it available on Craigslist. Greenhorns is another organization. These are more nationwide. So those are places to think about if you wanted to enter into that kind of exchange, making your land available to someone who already has something in mind that they would like to do with it, like a cut flower farm or all sorts of different uses. Alternately, you could list your land on, any of you familiar with WOOFing, if I say WOOFing? So WOOF is an acronym that stands for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. They've been around for a long time. They're one of the original land labor shared movement organizations. Their website is www.woofinternational.org. I don't have a PowerPoint. If you have any follow-up questions, I'll tell you exactly how to contact me. Don't feel like you have to write all this down. But what happens on a WOOF farm, if someone says that they're going to woof, you pay to join, whether you're going to make your property available or you want to see the world, and this is how you're going to do it. And I have very close friends who have woofed all over the Middle East, all over Europe, all over Southeast Asia. They stayed in India on an herb sanctuary for a year and a half. They were in Japan. They saw the entire world this way. So whether you're a woofer or a woofie, you join the WOOF organization, and it gives you access, and you can make your parcel available, or you can look for something. And that particular arrangement is 4 to 6 hours of volunteer work a day, and the people who are providing the labor are given food and accommodation. Sometimes there's also a stipend, but sometimes not. Sometimes it's just the labor that they provide.
It's cheap, too. It's like $50.
Yeah, it's not expensive to join. Exactly.
It's cheap.
So Wolfing, a similar organization, is called Workaway. Their website is workaway.info. And Workaway is a little bit more, it's very similar to Wolfing. It's a little bit more diversified. Some things are to babysit children. Others need help with farming or the upkeep of property. Some are hostel owners that own a hostel, and they need people to volunteer to clean rooms or to manage the bookings. That arrangement is 5 hours of work, 5 days a week, in exchange for room and accommodation. And that's usually the arrangement, is that there's room and board, generally not in exchange of payment, but sometimes that does happen. And then the last similar organization under this heading that I'm talking about of land share, garden share, farm share, is HelpX, helpx.net is the website. And they're pretty broad. They're an online listing of host organic farms, non-organic farms, farm stays, home stays, ranches, lodges, B&Bs. It's a very big umbrella. And I think that they're just, look at my notes, I think they're just 4 hours a week, four hours a day, sorry. And I'm not sure if that's 7 days a week. I'm going to guess there's some rest days, but it's also food and accommodation is provided. So those are ways that you could open up your land if you have a large project that you hope to, and you want to build a lot of infrastructure, you're converting your farm to a permaculture farm or something, and you're short on labor but big on ideas. This is something that you could potentially offer if you have spare room in your house or a yurt or an Airstream trailer or a tiny house or some kind of accommodation. I have friends that do it here regularly, a farm intern. And some kids are, I don't want to say kids, some people are just looking for experience opportunities and they're fine to not also be paid. But that's a way that you can potentially open up your land for whatever kind of endeavor. If you want to build stone walls or plant an orchard or what have you, that's a way that you could solicit labor onto your property. Any questions? The next potential use for your homestead would be for photo shoots, which might seem like an uncommon use, but for myself, I do it regularly because in addition to writing books, I do a lot of freelance writing. I have a website. If you want to contact me for anything, you can find me on my website. It's called Small Measure, just smallmeasure.com, and you can contact me on that. It also lists all my books and some other publications and things that I do. Photo shoots for all sorts of different potential uses. I don't know where you live, I don't know what kind of setting you have, but perhaps you have a couple acres or a beautiful creek adjacent to your property or a really epic oak tree on your land, something that's really potentially beautiful that would photograph well. A lot of photographers, when they do photo shoots, especially in outdoor natural environments, the biggest hazard are other people. If you're in a public park or some other setting where other people are there to enjoy the beauty, you gotta wait till they're like out of the shot, and you can't ask them to move because it's public use, they can be there. But if you have a setting that would be something that might be beneficial to a photographer, that could be something that you could make available. And the way that you would do that is you find out who the photographers are in your area. You could look them up online, you could look them up, you know, in the phone book, but find out who they are and say, hey, I have this parcel. And whatever arrangement you work out with them is going to be based on the particulars of your needs. Maybe you'd like some portraits of your family and you work out that kind of arrangement, or maybe it's a by use fee every time that they come, but that could be a potential use for your land. I have a friend locally who's a fashion designer, and she makes garments out of repurposed clothing, and she was doing a lookbook for her next season, and she needed specifically it to look really verdant and green, and I have a big bamboo grove on our property. And the photographer that she was working with knew that, and they reached out to me, and I said, of course. And we worked out an arrangement of reciprocity with social media. We were giving each other public mention and shout outs. So I didn't get any clothes, which would have been really cool, but I did get, you know, we were scratching each other's backs digitally, which I highly encourage you to never underestimate the power of social media. If you're not using it, I invite you to potentially reconsider or just find the medium that works best for you. My favorite is Instagram. I'm very fond of it, but I also use Twitter and Facebook. And what I like about social media is you have no idea the reach that it has. People that you might have never thought you'd be able to directly have communication with, that can happen through social media, and it's wonderful for business opportunities. So especially if you're trying to get the word out, like, hey, I've got this land, I want you to use it for photo shoots or whatnot, social media is a wonderful way to do that, because it really spreads. It the message gets out, and then other people spread it for you. So that's what I love about social media. Freelance magazine articles, if you are a writer and you need accompanying photographs, you can turn to your own property or home to provide the photographs. If you've got a good camera, that's something that you would be able to offer, potentially, a use for your land. The next topic of potential use are hosting any kind of classes, and it could be as wide and diverse as you can imagine. If you want to teach a beginning sewing class because you are a really adept seamstress or a big knitter and you know the people in the area that might want a beginning in-home, on-property lesson, or if you know how to can or teach any sort of class, if you have a topic, a skill that you could share, you know, dulcimer classes, fiddle classes, what have you, what is your wheelbarrow, what is your skill set that you could potentially teach a class or host a class. So I've done both on our property. I've taught a lot of classes myself at our house, but I've also hosted others. In the area here, there's a wild foraging expert named Alan Muscat, and Alan or his associates have led on our property about 7 or 8 wild foraging walks, and they do it through the season. And the classes are fantastic, they're very informative, but they're not cheap. And the arrangement that we worked out, because in addition to our 11 acres, our property flanks a 300-acre nature preserve, so there's all of this other land that we have access to. The woman that owns it lives on the other side of it. We worked out an arrangement where every time a class is led, my husband goes on the walk, or I go on the walk. And we're getting this seasonal information through the only time we don't do it is winter. And we're getting this amazing database of knowledge about what's available on the land. So that's something that you could host. I've had another friend who is an herbalist here in Asheville, and she wasn't looking for edible foods, she was looking for medicinal foods, and she led a wild walk through the woods, and then everyone came back into the kitchen and we cooked some food together. With her, she and I, the students were all charged a fee, and she and I worked up a proportion to distribute the fees between the two of us versus the wild food class, where it's just an exchange of knowledge and information. So that might be something where you can either host as the instructor or host another instructor to teach classes on your property. Yes?
How do you determine fair value?
Instead would be weddings or honeymoons. And a wedding, sometimes people have a wedding with a party of 20, sometimes there's a party of, you know, 200. So weddings are really variable, but you want to look at what you have to offer in terms of land, if you can accommodate a large crowd, or if it would need to be some kind of small, humble backyard occasion. But we were married on our property. My husband and I had a really, really short courtship. After we dated for 2 weeks, he asked me to marry him. And then we got married 4.5 months after that. And we've been together almost 9 years. So it can happen. You don't have to date for 3 years. But we got married on our property because when we started looking into, we love to entertain, first of all, but when we started looking into the cost of places to get married, it's exorbitant, and it needn't be that way, but I get it. You know, sometimes places come with all the amenities and a full catering staff, and some places are just parcels of land, but that might be something that you might want to consider. We rented a big tent like this and had food catered, and this exact same scenario repeated itself about 1.5 years ago. Very close friends of ours were engaged, and we had them over for dinner, and they were talking about looking around the area for where they could get married. And it was when my friend said, and if we get the matrimonial bridge, it's an extra $300, that I said, you don't need a matrimonial bridge. Just get married on our property. Just get married at our house. And so we did that. That was our gift to them for their wedding. And there are 150 people, and we have parking that can accommodate that. They rented, you know, porta-johns and whatnot, and they had a huge potluck, and it was a very low-cost wedding that was incredibly fun. I think the most they paid for was a tent rental in case it rained. But that's something that you might want to consider offering, making your property available. Yes? Exactly. I knew someone was going to ask me that. So the person that you would negotiate with the wedding, you would have them sign the waiver that would release you. But every guest, you know, on their way into the reception doesn't have to, like, sign the waiver. No, you would negotiate that with the bride and groom or the parents or whoever paying for. And if it's something that you offer to friends and you're not doing a cash exchange, then you can work out. I have a lot of friends who are artisans. This was our wedding gift to them, but if it was someone else that I knew more peripherally, I would say, well, maybe you could give me, you know, portraiture if you're a photographer, or ceramic goods if you're a potter, or whatnot, some sort of trade or barter arrangement. And if you don't know how to make that information, how do you get that information out there? You're like, yeah, I want to make my property available for weddings. Contact the florist in your area. They're going to know who the wedding planners are. If you have any kind of expo center that does wedding events where you live, put your flag up there, make it available. Hey, I've got, you know, 20 acres with organic flowers, cut flowers that you can have there in this beautiful setting. But you want to, after you've decided you're going to do this, you need to make sure you get the word out there. An organization like ASAP that I mentioned, the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project, you could hook up with them. They produce a wonderful guide every year to area. You pick farms and farm-to-table restaurants and B&Bs and wedding venues. So getting your name out there that way is something to consider. Make sure you have adequate parking before you do that. Yes. I can hear you.
Okay. I live out in a rural part of North Carolina. And I thought about some of this, but I have a lot of neighbors that have a lot of acreage too. Sometimes I'll have a fire hydrant going on. How, you know, I'm like, so that wouldn't work so good with like a wedding party.
Sure. So the way that I addressed it, the two weddings that we've had on our property, because we do have on our road, we live like about a half mile down a dirt road, but there are two other addresses on the property. We have, so the two occasions that we've done this, we've given them ample notice to let them know. And we have a certain time that it's like quiet time after that. So the wedding couldn't go on and, you know, be like a noise ordinance issue late into the evening after 10 o'clock. It has to quiet down. If they have a DJ, then it has to quiet down. And whoever is getting married will make their decision if that suits their needs. You know, if they want something that's like a full-on free-for-all, then maybe you're not the best place for them. If you have neighbors within earshot, that's something to definitely be mindful of. So the next possible use would be any kind of Airbnb or other B&B sort of arrangement. If you have a spare bedroom, even if it's just one room, or an outbuilding or space outside for a yurt or anything like that that you could rent out, that might be something that you want to consider. Side structure, an outbuilding, something like that where you could accommodate guests in your home or adjacent to your home. Nationally, the American Bed and Breakfast Association would be something that you would want to join. Their website is ABBA.com. I used to manage a bed and breakfast in Candler about 10 years ago, and we were part of ABBA, and we regularly received solicitations and calls from people nationwide. And the owners of the bed and breakfast that I worked for, I was the manager there, they purchased a house. It was a historic home built in the 1800s, and they loved the house. It came with a lot of beautiful rolling acreage with mountain views. They knew the only way that they'd be able to afford their mortgage was if they turned it into a B&B. It was a 5-bedroom house, and their quarters were on the bottom floor, tucked in the back, away from the guests, and the top 2 floors were rented out. And they had nearly regular occupancy. If you have children, if you want to travel a lot, there are things to think about before you open your house up as a bed and breakfast. nowadays online, you can have what your blackout dates are, and you can say, this is where we're going on vacation, or we don't take guests around the holidays, or, you know, you want to make sure you have a life too, because when you do become a bed and breakfast, you really are beholden to your guests. When we would go to the grocery store to shop for breakfast supplies, we would roll the phone over to the cell phone so that we could answer, you know, standing in the grocery store. We had the book with us to write down reservations. It can be pretty, a pretty high needs sort of way of making use of your homestead, but it can also be really lucrative. So that's something you might want to consider, especially during times of year. If you live in an area where there's like vibrant foliage or music festivals or something where a lot of people, you know, are coming into town and there's large demand, an in-home accommodation is something that people are highly desirous of. Sometimes they have pets or they have children and they couldn't otherwise go to a hotel, especially with pets. And that's something you need to consider too, is whether you would allow things like that. But opening up your home for guests, for lodging, and possibly for meals, you could also consider doing farm dinners with the bed and breakfast. That's an additional cost that you could add on. Things like that are things to think about for bed and breakfast or bed and breakfast-like associations. Similar to that would be glamping. Are you familiar with the term glamping? Oh, so glamorous, yeah. Camping.
Yeah.
And that can be done in RVs or yurts or yones or platforms that have kind of military issue style canvas walled tents. A little bit of a step up for folks who want their outdoor experience but don't want to give up all of the amenities of a comfortable mattress and lots of nice linens and things like that. People don't want to rough it. They want to put a little toe in on roughing it, but not the full, you know, not a whole hog. And that can be a great way to diversify your homestead if you have structures that you can erect on your land, and you could consider possibly offering up a breakfast to them as well, or like a snack basket, things like that, other things of value that you can add, amenities, and then you would make a profit off of that. So that's something to consider if we're talking about tiny homes. If the structure is on a platform and it's on wheels, it actually becomes under the province of the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's considered a recreational vehicle and is not allowed to be occupied continuously. So people that live in city limits might want to think about that. There are a lot of codes and ordinances against full-time occupancy of anything that's considered a recreational vehicle unless it's in a designated RV park within city limits. If you're outside of city limits, it's a lot more lax. It's a lot more up to interpretation, especially if you as the property owner have a lot of land that you can make available. If it's a tiny house with a foundation that's not on wheels, then it's fine. As long as you are in code with whatever city that you live in, their building codes and ordinances, then that's fine. But the tiny house movement is intensely popular. There are websites devoted exclusively to vacationing in tiny homes, tinyhouselistings.com and tinyhousevacations.com are places where you could list your property. So something to think about. And then homeaway.com or vrbo.com are other accommodations. Listings for people that are going on vacation. So when I taught this class last time, so at the end, because I was soliciting feedback from other people, someone recommended if you have land that isn't really arable or that isn't really amenable to growing on for farming, you could make your land available as a solar farm. So your land would actually be a host for solar panels. That's something that you could consider, especially if the land isn't, you know, otherwise able to be used for growing. American Whitewater is an organization where you can list if you happen to have access to a river point or any kind of place for whitewater rafting entry, camping points along the route that people might be whitewater rafting on. That's something that you can list yourself, and you could, you know, have whatever sort of fee that you would list for that use. Similarly with rock climbing, if you have, there's a database, a nationwide database for rock climbing access points, especially if it's on private property, that you could make, that you want to have liability waivers there for sure. But that's something that you could, if you have terrain that could accommodate rock climbers. Orcharding or U-pick farms, something that you could do with your land. It's definitely more agrarian, but it's also tourist in nature as well. Growing up, my grandmother lived in Chesapeake, Virginia, and her husband had a full-time job. He was a manager at a car dealership in Chesapeake, and my grandmother had a job as well, but they had this farm that they grew all their own produce. They had chickens, they had a goat, a crazy goat. But she also, when she purchased the property, it had this massive row of very well-established, very large blueberry bushes. And so they opened the property as a U-pick berry farm. This was decades ago, before the internet, where you could make yourself known as a U-pick farm. She went to the local newspaper for her area, and they did a whole story on it. And then she had a sign up at the end of her driveway always. And I remember so many times people coming and knocking on the door, and she'd give them like a gallon milk jug that had a side cut out of it, and that's what they would use. And they would go blueberry picking, and it was always just a cash or check exchange. But that might be something if you want to become some sort of fruit or berry, soft fruit or hard fruit orchard, especially if it's something that's in high demand but scarce, like persimmons or Asian pears or pawpaws or hazelnuts or things that people are highly desirous of in your area but that aren't readily available. That might be something for a niche sort of specialty market for you pick. Flower farms, you pick flower farms. That's where you would definitely want to have connections with the wedding planners in your area so that they're going to get that information out to prospective brides and grooms looking for flower costs for weddings are exorbitant. They are prohibitively expensive for a lot of people, but you pick farms aren't. And a lot of them are, you know, if you're an organic farm that's certified organic, that's something that people are even more desirous of too, to go out and harvest their own weddings. And it, again, like I mentioned with fruits and nuts that are desirous but scarce, if you had hoop houses where you grew tulips, or I don't know how well informed some of you might be about the floral market, but it's pretty ridiculous what happens to most flowers that are grown internationally. Even if they're going to be sold in the U.S., almost all of them have to go to Holland and be sold on the floral market and then be shipped back to where they can be sold in the States, even if they're grown here. So there's a growing demand for domestic flower farms. I have a friend who lives in the Seattle area, and she is on the internet, Floret Farm, F-L-O-R-E-T, and it's a cut your own farm, but she also sells directly to a lot of natural food stores like Whole Foods. She's a certified organic farm, and she's just started her own line of seeds as well. So that might be something if you have a lot of land that, and you have a lot of ample sunlight, that you could do with your farm. Christmas tree farms, something to consider if you live in an area where Christmas trees can grow. We went to a local, we've done it a couple of times, but we went to a new farm this year out here in the area, and it was packed. I went the day, I was so ready this year. I was like, come on, Christmas. So the day after Thanksgiving, we went and got our Christmas tree, and it was incredibly fun. There were hay rides and animals and music, and you know, you got out there and you cut your tree, and it was absolutely, I have a five-year-old son. He was so into it, and so was I. But that's something that you can think about. And pumpkin patches, ways to diversify your property too, if you're growing things that have a continuum. So it's not like in one fell swoop you make all your money and it's crazy labor and really intense. The Christmas tree farm that we went to is also in the summer a U-pick berry farm. They have tomatoes that you can harvest. To something like that in the fall, maybe where you have a pumpkin patch and a corn maze, and then it segues into Christmas trees that you do, and then in the spring, and so on and so forth. So that might be something that you want to think about for diversified uses of your property. Alternate structure siting. So if you have land and someone has one of those tiny houses on wheels that they can't have in the city, but you have land, you might want to engage in a relationship with them where you let them house their structure on your property. We've done this with two different individuals on our own property. We have friends that live in Decatur, Georgia, and they are both full-time school teachers. They have very busy jobs, but they have a five-year-old daughter. These are the friends that I mentioned that have done the woofing all over the world. Well, now they're set in Atlanta, and they teach, and they are very busy with their careers. But they really missed their time living out. When they were in India, they built their own house out of thatch and bamboo and had monkeys in their hut with them. And now they're in Atlanta. But they wanted a space where they could retreat with their daughter and come to the mountains. And we all met here in college years ago. So they saw a yurt that was for sale here. And if you're not familiar with a yurt, it's a circular structure with fabric walls and a domed roof. And they are originally from Mongolia, and they're portable housing, like a tent, but that you can reinforce and buttress and have a wood stove in, so a source of heat. And they bought one, and they put it on our land. Well, they're like some of my closest friends, so similarly to not having people that you love sign a waiver to come to your house, I said, well, how about you just have this on your land? It's your, you know, little respite when you come into town. And our arrangement will be that we can use it to house guests whenever. If I'm writing a book and I want a quiet space, I can go down there. I can go down and exercise or what have you. And that's the arrangement that we've had with them. We also have a friend who has a tiny house, and she worked with a local company to build it. It was their prototype model. But then she started running into, because it's on wheels, all of the challenges of having her home in Asheville. And I said, well, why don't you just put it out on our property? We have a utility pole right beside it. She could plug it in because it's electric. And so that's what we did with her. And she owns a business in Asheville, and we have a standing discount at her store. She also helps me in the garden and doing kitchen things for about 3 or 4 hours of labor a week. So working out some sort of arrangement like that, if you know, you want to make your property available for housing, your sort of tiny homes or things along those lines, it's a potential use for your land.
Question.
Yes.
How much does that interfere with your privacy?
It's a great question. So on our particular land, where those structures are, there's two fields. The question was, how is our privacy compromised by having these other individuals on your land? And it's going to be based on proximity, how much land you have. With our particular location, where these structures are is down in a field. There's a big forest grove in between, and up a hill tucked into a forested nook is our house. So it's completely private. When all the foliage is leafed out, I have no idea what's going on down there. In the winter, sometimes I'll see headlights coming in at night, but it's otherwise very private. That's definitely something you want to consider if you have, if privacy is of concern for you, if you want to make sure that there's, you know, forest in between, or they're far enough away on the land that it's not going to interfere with where you are and your comings and goings and what, because they're going to be desirous of their privacy as equally as you are of yours. So that's something you definitely want to consider. How, you know, how much land you have available. If you have 200 acres, put them way, put them way away from you. But that's something to absolutely factor in. Education. So when I was researching my chicken book, in each of these books, I profile people that are doing what I'm talking about, whether it's for pleasure or for profit, if it's their business and they're, you know, dairy makers, if they're professional beekeepers, or if they're just hobbyists. For my chicken keeping book, I interviewed a friend who was a farm manager at a permaculture farm in Barnardsville, which is just north of Asheville, and he was doing some really cool permaculture stuff with chickens, with growing fruits that would fall in the area where they were fenced in so that they could feed themselves, with pallets all scattered all over the ground, that when you lift the piece of wood, there's insects, which is what chickens want to eat more than anything. They're insectivores primarily, and then they're herbivores secondarily. So if you have chickens, that's a great cheap way to encourage bugs, is to have pieces of wood all over the run, stone pavers that you can get, you know, at the Lowe's or Home Depot. You lift them over every few days. There's a lot of bugs. The chickens will come to learn what's going on. But I was interviewing my friend who was managing this farm, and while I was there, I saw, it wasn't his property, he was just the farm manager, I saw a yurt there, and I asked him about it, and he said that it was the schoolhouse for a homeschooling cooperative in that little community on that particular road in Barnardsville. And the man who owned the home and the land owns a yurt company, a local Asheville yurt company called Red Sky Yurts. And he and his wife and some other people in the community at the time had young children, and they jointly went in together and bought the yurt. And then they hired collaboratively a teacher to come like twice a week and homeschool in this homeschool cooperative. So that's something you might want to think about, like up at Sacred Mountain Sanctuary that I referred to at the beginning of the conversation. They had a 300-acre parcel of land, and they divvied it up. So there's residential, there's educational, and the educational program that they have goes up through the eighth grade. The structures, aside from the star seeds, which are the youngest children, the 3 to 6-year-olds, all of the other grades are in yurts. They're in these, you know, roundhouse tent-like structures and available on this land that's otherwise owned by a private individual. So that's something to think about. Make your property, especially if you have a really active and viable homeschool culture in your area, that might be something that you want to think about making available. Agriculture hosting. So what I mean by that is if you have land available for agricultural grazing, people that have cattle that they need to move around and rotate, you could, especially if they're your neighbors or nearby, adjacent to you, you could make your land available that way. People that are looking for places to situate their beehives, if you've got, and especially if they want to have an organic honey business, certified organic, and you've got land that you, and within a certain radius, because bees do have a radius that they fly, you know it's certified organic or what have you. Maybe they don't even want certified organic. They just need places to put more hives because they have a honey business. That's something that you could offer. And again, whatever the particular arrangement that you enter into with them, whether it's they give you honey or you charge a land use fee or what have you, that's up to you. That's at your discretion for you to figure out. But that's something to think about, making this land available. I have a friend who's doing that locally with a beekeeper who is, he's been at it for decades. And when he comes and services his beehives, he also services hers too. So that's a way that she is in this really mutually beneficial relationship. And she loves beekeeping, but it's one less thing. You know, she's homeschooling her kids. She's got 25 acres. She's got a fiber business. She's already really busy. It's one less thing she has to worry about. So that's something, some sort of arrangement that you could do, some kind of agricultural hosting. Nature stock photography is something that I'd never heard of, but I've recently learned is quite commonly done. There are ways to, if you have an abundance of wildlife on your property, or even like wild pollinators, butterflies, if you're on a migratory path route for certain types of birds or anything that could be photographed and potentially sold as stock photography, if you could create wild pollinator habitats that would, you know, draw these different pollinators and whatnot to come, and then you can photograph them right there on your property, that's the way that you can then economically benefit from your own land. So something to think about with creating nature stock photography. I've heard of a photographer in Costa Rica. He lives in Costa Rica, but he takes Costa Rican rainforest nature photography and then sells that. And you can either then sell the photography directly, or you can align yourself with nature stock photography companies, and then they do all of that on your behalf. And whenever one of your images is sold, they took a portion of the proceeds, and then you also benefit too. So that's something that you could consider doing. If you're on a migratory bird route or in an area that has a really dense population of birds, you could also host your land as a bird watching location. There are people who, that's their hobby, that's their passion. And making your land available. And people who come to birdwatch are a pretty chill crowd, so you don't have to worry about it getting too raucous or anything. They're going to come with their seed and their binoculars and a hot cup of tea, and it's going to be a really relaxed situation. But making that available on your property, or on a migratory route for some really stellar bluebirds that come through in the winter. And this past January, I was walking back from my chicken coop in the morning, and in the winter here, it's stark, it's gray, it's very, you know, pretty barren. And I saw this shock of blue over on my left side, and I was like, oh my God, they're here. And there are about 30 of them right off the patio. And I ran inside and told my husband, and he's like, get the bird feed. You know, we have this short window before they leave. And they come every year. And if they know that you are a safe location for food on their migratory routes, then that's a wonderful opportunity for you to collect photographs and use for nature stock photography. Fishing, similarly, if you have a pond that you could stock with fish and make your land available. My mom lives in Burnsville, about an hour north of here, and on my route to her house, there is a big pond, and people come and they pay a usage fee for each time that they go fishing, and the pond is regularly stocked. That might be something that you want to consider doing on your land, or if you have a creek where people could do, you know, fly fishing or whatnot, a river, if you have any kind of water access. Some kind of aquatic fishing arrangement would be something that you might want to consider. Wild foraged items, it's the last thing I have on my list. Whether you want to have a use fee to allow people to come and wild forage on your land, or if you want to glean things yourself and then turn them into value-added commodities, maybe you harvest ramps and then you render them into pickled ramps or ramp vinegar or what have you. Or you allow people to come. If you allow people to come, it is best to have them be aware of sustainable harvesting practices so that others can come after them and sustainably harvest. In my Handmade Gatherings book, I have a wild foods potluck, and I have a whole printout on a page of how to sustainably wildcraft. So you definitely want to make sure, you know, if it's ginseng or something especially rare, or morels, if you want to give up your precious morels, but maybe you have more than you could ever enjoy yourself. That's something that people are incredibly desirous of. So you can send them out on their own after you've educated them how to do it mindfully and sustainably. Or you could glean those things yourself and then turn them into products that you sell at market. I think that is about, if anyone has any other suggested uses for land, anything that you've done. But otherwise, there's a lot of potential ways to diversify what you're doing on your land that's other than just like a straight farm. So hang in there, have fun, and get a liability waiver. Thank you very much.